This is the afternoon session of the first day of the hearings of the Attica Commission. We resume, continuing the testimony of Mr. William Jackson.
I should say that on my left is Charles Willis, and on my right is Stephen Rosenfeld, two of my colleagues. The further left is Andrew Little and Paul Roldan, also of our staff, were sitting there a few moments ago. Mr. Jackson, you testified earlier this morning about how you were warned before you arrived at Attica by a ex-convict who had been there about the possibility of homosexual attack. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
What was the reality at Attica?
Oh, there was, an inmate is, he has no outlet for any of his sexual thing, and so a lot of them, this really manifests itself, and they become, what they call rough-off artists, it's a literal rape, the guy explained it to me, so that, in my own circumstance, I found out there were certain areas in the prison which were dangerous areas, if you want to put it that way. So I just tried to stay away from these particular areas.
Now, what were the areas that you felt you had to stay away from?
I didn't want to work in the metal shop because of the atmosphere there, and also the chapel at times.
You felt you couldn't go in the chapel for that reason at times?
Well, yes, at times, right.
Was it essentially any area in which there were secluded spots?
This is it. Any area where, where they'd be alone, or something.
Did you have to be on your guard all the time?
Well, yes. You had eyes in the back of your head all the time.
Did you carry a weapon?
Got a piece of was a piece of steel, It was ground down, commonly referred to as a shank. You had one of those.
And is that pretty common for inmates who want to avoid these advances?
Well, it discourages them. I'll put it that way. When you have something like this.
In fact, were you subject at any time to an attack?
I got into one fight. This was on a gallery. Another guy, we got into a fight, and it was broken up later by correction officers.
And what was the outcome of that fight in resisting an attack?
I went to this adjustment committee. This is made up of a correction officer, usually one of the higher echelon officers, a parole officer, and a service unit man, and they determine what your sentence will be inside the institution. In this particular case, I received a keep lock for 2 days.
For getting into a fight?
To protect your manhood, right?
Now, what is a keep lock?
This is when they lock you in a cell, and they feed you in the cell. You're not allowed out for anything. You stay right in the cell 24 hours a day.
Now, I'd like to address some questions to you about subjects that came up in our interviewing of 1,500 or 1,600 inmates as sources of discontent at the prison. Was there much discussion when you were there about comparative sentences?
Much so. There's many cases. I could use my own case for an example, but one particular instance, I was working in the identification department, and there's two inmates that come in the same day from different areas, and they were taking their photographs, and we was preparing all of the identification materials, and they got to talking amongst themselves, and one was an older black guy, and one was a young black guy, and they got to talking, and a young black guy says, the old one, he says, what you doing time for? And the guy says, robbery too. And the other guy says, well, so am I. We're doing the same thing. And the young, old guy says to the young one, you've been down before? In other words, he means, have you been in prison before? And he says, no. The old guy says, yeah, this is my third or fourth time. And the young guy says, the old guy, what'd you get? It was either 3 or 4 years. And the young guy says, I got 15. This is my first time. And boy, he says, you know, it just draws a lot of animosity out because here they are. The old guy, he knows the vagaries of the criminal system. He had a plea bargaining, and he got a deal. And it was a different county. It was possibly downstate, where upstate, you know, they'll give him a larger sentence. So here's two men with comparable circumstances, but not comparable backgrounds, and they received this wide disparity in sentencing.
And are there other examples of that?
I know, like, the law changed in New York State from the old penal law to the new in 1967. And I know a man that's doing 60 to 100 years for two armed robberies, and under the new law, the most he could get would be 30 years.
And what's the effect of that type of thing in Attica?
Oh, this breeds a lot of discontent. A man is, in effect, a 60 to 100 year sentence is a life sentence. This is... you know, you have no opportunity. And he sees a young guy or some guy come in and he done a comparable crime, and at this day and age he may get 4 or 5 years for the same crime.
How did you feel about your own sentence of from 0 to 7 years for selling marijuana?
Well, it kind of makes me feel bad because I see people who got indicted for murder, cop out to a manslaughter charge, and get 3 or 4 years. And then I got 7 for 3 bags of marijuana. It really does. It irritates me.
Is it an embittering experience?
It certainly is. I mean, then you read in the newspaper of people who get arrested and people who have money or a name, and maybe 2 or 3 times they're arrested, and they always get a probation or a fine. And yet, my first arrest, I got 7 years.
Now, did you have occasion to meet the parole board?
Yes, sir, I did.
How many times did you meet the parole board?
Twice.
And for what purpose?
Under this new law, an indeterminate sentence, the parole board sets the minimum. It's called a MPI hearing, minimum period of incarceration. And this is held 10 months after your original incarceration, which for me was September 1970.
Now, what happened at this meeting with the parole board?
Well, you go in there and they talked to me. They just said that you was convicted for a marijuana offense, and we're here to determine your minimum. And I was in there at the most 3 minutes. It was just a general thing like this. It was all facts that they had on hand, and they says, we'll set your minimum and we'll let you know. This was the entire thing.
Did they let you know?
Yes. It was 2 days later I found out what I had received for a minimum.
And what was your minimum?
2 years and 4 months. This was the maximum they, under law, they was allowed to give me. They gave me all of it.
Was there any explanation given to you?
No. I asked about it, and they says they don't have to give explanations. This is entirely at their discretion.
Now, what about the second time you met them?
I met them in February 1972, and it was just nearly a repeat performance of the first time. I go in, you're there 3 or 4 minutes, and they, in 3 or 4 minutes, they decide the whole future of your life.
How many men are there?
There's usually 3 commissioners and several correction officers for security.
And this is right in the prison?
Yes, sir.
And you're wearing prison garb?
Yes, sir.
Now, at your second hearing, what was the outcome?
I was granted what is called an open date on program. This means that I will be given parole upon providing a suitable housing and obtaining a job prior to my release.
Now, open dates are common, am I correct, in terms when the parole board grants parole?
Yes, sir. This is the usual mode of release.
And do I understand that before you are released, you have to have a job?
Yes, sir.
Now, how does an inmate in Attica go about getting a job while he's still in the prison?
Well, prior to the uprising, they had phone books, and you could look in them, but many times they were 4 or 5 years old. You look in the newspapers, and you get addresses. Well, and if you wish to write prior to going to the parole board, which is nearly a necessity, you even have to pay the postage for the letters. And you get names of firms or something that would be in your line or something you could do, and you write to these people. In my case, I wrote 55 letters, and I obtained a job through a man whom I had known prior to my incarceration, and he gave me a job.
And until you got the job, you were not released, even though the parole board had said you could go once you had it, am I correct?
Yes, sir. I received the job offer in January, and my date was set for March 13th. And 10 weeks later, they finally completed the investigation of the job, and I was granted release on March 20th.
Did anybody give you any help in the prison in finding a job? Are you given any help in locating a job?
No, it's entirely up to you. It's your responsibility. I mean, if you want out, you got to do it all, do it on your own. Like I say, I had to pay my own postage. I could have waited until after I'd went to the parole board and then wrote for jobs. But by the time the mails go, you'll finally eventually get a job. You're already over your date, and then it'll take them 4 to 6 weeks to investigate the job. You're incarcerated during this entire period. So it's best to write them beforehand.
You ultimately helped yourself in getting the job through a friend, am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, is it unusual to write as many as 55 letters before you get a job?
Not at all. I've seen men write 200-300 of them. It's hard to find a job. Unemployment as it is, and there's men standing outside the door looking for a job, and then you get a letter from an ex-con or a convict in prison. It's hard.
How do you arrange to be interviewed when you're in prison for the job?
There is no interviews. I mean, they say that you can get one through the service unit. I've never heard of it or seen it. It's usually just writing. You have to go for a minimum job when you're writing for jobs out of an institution. It's a standard thing, $1.85 an hour jobs.
Incidentally, you said that phone books were made available so that you could, I suppose, take names off the yellow pages?
Yes, sir.
Were you allowed to make telephone calls?
No. You can't make telephone calls. I was there 2.5 years, and I never made a telephone call. I don't know anybody that did.
Could you receive telephone calls, except
no.
In an emergency?
No, if you do receive a call, they take a message, and they'll deliver it to your cell when they deliver the mail.
So that for the 2.5 years you were there, you never spoke to your family on the telephone?
No, sir.
And the only time you saw your wife was when she
came
up?
Came for visits.
And you didn't see your children at all?
No, I didn't see my children for 2.5 years.
Now, what's the atmosphere in Attica like when the parole board comes to meet? How often does it come?
They come once a month, and just prior to them coming, everybody that's going to the board, everybody else knows it, because it's really tense, because they don't know. The parole system has no criteria set up so you can make parole. You don't know. It's people who you don't think are going to make it, and it's so arbitrary, you just don't know. And so naturally, they're very impersonal about giving you the parole slip. Like, you go in and you talk to the parole people, and when you get all done, instead of telling you what their decision is, and getting it over with then, or at least letting you explain away any bad parts in your record or anything, they're very impersonal. They say, "We'll let you know." And so they wait till they're going out the door, and then the slips are passed around. So then, then you find out what you got.
And what's the atmosphere like when those slips come out?
Despair, You don't know. It's everybody. It hits everybody differently. You know, guys that are sure, well, I'm gonna make parole this time. You know, I've had a really clean record and everything. He gets back a slip that says 2 years, and then another man who, different circumstances, maybe, you know, had a lot of key blocks or something, he'll go and he'll get an open date.
Are you ever told what's expected of you by the parole board?
The parole board itself doesn't. Like, a parole officer just told me, keep your nose clean and don't get in any trouble. That was about the extent of that.
Well, and you kept your nose clean for those first 10 months? And
yes, sir.
How did you feel when you got hit with the maximum bit you could?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it was, you know, I mean, I figured, I went 10 months, I didn't have any disciplinary reports. So I figured, you know, they'll give me, you know, maybe a shot, especially being a first offender. And when I got the slip back, it was really, you know, it's really a heartbreak. You know, my family was really expecting it. My wife called up trying to find out what I had gotten and everything.
Were you ever punished while you were at Attica, other than the one occasion you mentioned where you had been in a fight and resisting in advance?
Yes, one other occasion. I had a stove in my cell.
How did you get a stove?
I made it. You get a piece of fire brick and you dig a little groove in it, and you mount a piece of nichrome wire in it, and you plug it in, and this way you can have like warm soup or toast or, you know, something to eat at nights.
And what was your punishment for that?
I was given a one-day suspended sentence on that one.
What was your relationship to the correction officers at Attica? How would you describe it?
It varies with each individual. I worked with one correction officer, but was really out of sight. The guy was really nice. But then you meet other ones, and it's so different. Like, this guy was out of sight, and he'd treat you right, you know? And never no hassles or bother you or anything. But then you'll meet another one who'll be beating a stick on the wall and hollering, line up, march, and get into this military thing. And everybody's different. I mean, there's no set standard for the correction officers or what they do.
Did this regimentation appear to affect the older inmates differently from the younger ones?
Well, they've grown to accept it. Many of them have spent extended periods in incarceration, and to them, you know, it's it doesn't seem to bother them. But to a younger man, a person who is not ready to accept this type of thing, it's hard for him. He don't want to, you know, especially some of these Mickey Mouse regulations, if you want to call them that, you know.
Like what?
Oh, the line up exactly according to height. Then you're locked in. Things like they could have maybe a recreation or something. All these regulations that they have, just small minor things.
Do they build up the small minor things?
Different officers do it different ways. I mean, like some officers, as I said earlier, will leave a drop or go, you know, this illegal heating device. Whereas another one will... he has a perfect right to pinch you for it because it is an illegal heating device, but yet they're in common use.
Now, you're a white person, and you're from a rural area. Is that
yes,
correct?
Sir.
Do you think that your relationship with the correction officers was in any way different from the relationship of the majority of the population at Attica?
Oh, I really do, because... For one, I can relate a lot to the people who work there. That most of them are white, in fact, they're all white, and I can relate to them, and they could understand me. But you get a person who's coming, like some blacks from New York, they would be talking in the yard, and the correction officer don't even know what he said. Don't even, you know, has no idea. He can't relate to this person whatsoever. So naturally, they give you I got a better job, and they give you a little a better play at everything.
You think you got preferred treatment?
Well, certainly. I mean, I got an extra shower then after I got this job, and I had a good job. This is a major thing.
Were there changes in the inmate population while you were at Attica over that 2.5 year period?
I would say there was. Especially working in the identification, the inmates seemed to become more younger. That's a poor term. They became younger and more aware. They seemed to be more aware of what's going on around them, what is happening, you know, and very discontent, you know. I mean, a lot of the older inmates are gradually fading away, and this younger breed of inmate, many of them for drug crimes, etc., they are a little more aware of what's going on around them and everything.
And what was the effect on the correction officers as you observed it?
Well, anybody who, when your books would come in, like if somebody was reading any type of a literature which, you know, they considered revolutionary and militant, this was really bad. They would, you know, they would really come down on these people, you know, because they figured they want to change it, you know, and they just really got uptight about the whole thing.
And what was the mood at Attica prior to the uprising in September? How would you describe it?
Well, early in the year, they had made the changes from calling it a prison, they changed it to a correctional facility, they changed the name of the guards to correction officers, and a lot of these changes, and we really, the people inside, expected there's going to be some changes, but there were none. The names were the change, but the thing inside was all the same. There's nothing changed. So we kept expecting it, and it was a lot of tenseness, and then later a manifesto was made up of just simple human things that was asked for. And shortly thereafter, Mr. Oswald came and made a visit to the prison.
Now that was the first week in September, just before the uprising.
Yes, sir.
And you hear Mr. Oswald speak on the tape system at the institution. He had a tape speech to the inmates.
Yes, sir. It was the radio operator announced that there would be a tape speech for at 7 o'clock by Mr. Oswald. So everybody had the earphones on, and I listened to it too. Everybody did.
And what was the reaction to the speech? You heard him talk about reform and changes. What was the reaction to this speech?
Everybody, I took my earphones off, and all I could hear was earphones hitting the wall and people hollering, "That's a cop out, it's a cop out." Because he didn't do nothing. All he said was, "Well, we'd like to do this and we'd like to do that." He didn't so much as make one concession, such as giving a man soap or giving a man an extra shower. He didn't make any concessions whatsoever.
Do you think that the visit helped reduce the frustration?
No, if it did anything, it increased it even more so.
That's your opinion?
Yes, sir.
And that's based on the...
My personal knowledge of what was going on inside.
Now, you were there for 2.5 years, and under this regime of spending most of your time in your cell and marching to various places to eat, to work, did you make any effort to obtain a place in medium or minimum security institution?
Yes, sir. Right. Upon my initial appearance, when I first came to Attica, this was in November, December 1969, I requested to be transferred to the one of the camps. These are minimum security camps. And I wrote to the service unit and the parole office. And an answer was sent back saying that I had too much time. I had 7-year maximum, and the maximum allowable to go to these camps was a 5-year maximum. So I was ineligible to go to these camps.
Now, after you got your date from the parole board, which I think you said was about, all told, 2 years and 4 months?
Yes, sir.
Did you then try to go to the camps?
After I had over 2 years in, this would cut my minimum down to less than 5 years. This was in October 1971. I again wrote to Mr. Oswald and the service unit to find out if I would be eligible to go to one of these minimum security camps. And at this time, they told me that I was too old to go to the camp, so I still didn't meet the criteria.
There was no place for you in any of the lesser security institutions?
No, sir.
Now, you talked about carrying a weapon for self-protection. Were there periodic cell searches at Attica to look for weapons and contraband?
Oh, yes. They would, different times, of to be what they call a shakedown. Men would be in the mess hall, and when you would come out, they would have two rows of officers lined up right down the hallway, and you'd march between them, and then they would have you, you know, stand up against the wall, and they'd search you, personal search, and then they would have cell searches when you were at work and stuff.
What was the impact of those practices?
Well, many men who didn't have nothing in their cell and didn't have nothing on them, they would go on into their cells, and they don't have to live there, so they tear the thing up. I mean, they do a thorough search, and that, when the way that they search is just the way they leave it. They pull the books off the wall and throw them on the bed and turn the mattress over, and when they get done, they walk out. That's it.
Are you speaking from personal experience?
Yes, sir, I am.
Did that also vary from officer to officer?
It certainly did. Some officers would be reasonable. They would come in and they'd say, well, I got to do a search of your cell. You stand over there by the door. And this wouldn't be bad. The guy would, you know, check things out. And I had another case where an officer come on in my house, one that tore it up. And during the entire search, he made me stand outside the door with my hands up against the wall and my feet spread apart. It took him probably 20 minutes to search it.
Now, on parole, are you under certain restrictions?
Yes, sir.
And would you describe what the restrictions are as long as you remain on parole?
I have a 11 o'clock curfew. I have, right now I have no driver's license. And this really is restricting me because I live in a rural area. There's no public transportation, and I'm trying to get back and forth to work. At the present time, my wife gets up 3 hours early, drives me to work, comes back, and then she gets ready, and the kids go to school. And then when I get out of work, I have to wait, and she drives out and picks me up. This is one of the major ones that really hurts in my particular area.
And if you violate parole, what can happen?
If I violate, they can just take me back to the institution, reincarcerate me, and make me finish the entire period.
Now, you understood that when you were sentenced, you were being committed to Attica for punishment and for rehabilitation. Did you hear the judge utter words like that, that when your sentence was passed?
Yes, he said something similar to that.
You now have spent over 2.5 years there during a very turbulent period. As you reflect back on it, do you think that in your case the incarceration served these purposes?
When I was originally incarcerated, nobody during my entire period ever spoke to me about marijuana. Nobody ever said a thing to me. It was strictly a punishment thing. I never even had a talk with anybody about it.
You were in for a marijuana offense?
Yes, sir. I never had so much of a discussion with any personnel about, you know, marijuana or anything like this. It was just a thing of doing that time, do whatever the judge says you had to do or the parole board, and then leave. It was that was the way the whole thing was set up.
And you say you didn't have a discussion with anybody. You had mentioned earlier that the parole board questioned you about your offense, but nobody at the prison itself talked to you about marijuana or the things that you were put into jail for?
No, sir. The whole time, you know, while you're here for giving away this marijuana, you have anything you want to discuss about the case? Are you guilty? I would tell them, well, I've got appeals pending. Well, we won't talk about it then.
That's the parole board.
Right. Well, this was also the service unit or the parole officer himself.
Do you think that Attica did anything to help you adjust to society and its rules?
None whatsoever. You, while you're living in there, everything is regimented. You aren't expected to make any decisions for yourself. They treat you like a child. And yet they'll take you and they'll just push you out in there and say, okay, now you go on back out in the world and you become a good citizen and everything because we've really done a great thing for you. And it really does nothing. It's like 2.5 years somebody took and says, well, you can't have this part of your life. We're just going to throw that away. It's out of your existence. You lost that. That's how Attica reacted to me.
I have no further questions of this witness, Dean McKay.
Mr. Jackson, I'd like to ask you one or two questions, and perhaps other members of the commission would.